Hey everybody, welcome back to Engaging the Phenomenon. And today we are truly honored to have on a very special guest, and that is Dr. Gary Nolan, who is a Stanford University professor, and he runs the Nolan Lab. So welcome, Gary.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, and again, I really truly appreciate you being here. I think that you're probably one of the most important people that is looking at this issue right now on a larger scale. Not only are you looking into the issue, but you're, you know, trying to tackle it through the lens of science. And I think that's what's greatly needed at this time, rather than a lot of speculations that go on. You're actually doing the science.
Well, I think, you know, the important part for people to understand is that even the science is not absolute, right? You publish something at a moment in time with the best knowledge that you have available and the best tools that you have available. And you're basically planting a flag in the sand to say, this is what we know, or what we think we know at this point, are always being willing to be proven wrong later. You know, that you might have done something wrong, you might have artifactually, you might have created an artifact in the study. You know, but again, that's the reason why I like, or I focus on, the notion of peer review. Because what peer review does is it says, I'm not just going by what I think. I've had other experts in the area anonymous so that they can offer true critique. And they've looked at it and they said, well, as far as we can tell, this is right. And most papers, very few papers, frankly, get accepted right out of the submission. It usually is a couple of going back and forth with the reviewers as you tailor it to what the reviewers think. And sometimes the reviewers are wrong, or you, frankly, more often than not, have not explained things correctly or well enough. So you use the reviewers essentially as a sounding board to basically make the paper better. But that's the standard. So then you can put it out there saying this has been, you know, tested, at least intellectually, by other experts in the field. But you always have to be willing, you know, if you have materials that can be shared, to share those materials so that others can test it. And, you know, that's always the best. It's always better to have somebody else say you're right than for you to say that you're right.
Yeah. And again, I think it's important that you're doing this work because, you know, obviously there's other people who have come before, but I mean, you're certainly setting a standard and kind of allowing other scientists and academics to kind of step into this field credibly, because I think you represent the work the way it ought to be done. So some people are going to be familiar with a little bit of your background, but how did you get involved into looking at the UFO question?
Well, I, as I've said in a couple of other interviews, I've always been interested in science fiction. And, you know, frankly, I just was poking around on YouTube one day. And I've been following a lot of the YouTube videos and things. And this was back around 2010 or so.
Yeah.
It was intriguing. And, you know, you're bored on a Saturday afternoon and you look at this stuff. and I had come to know some guy up in Oregon who'd been posting videos. And at one point, he tweeted me something about the little Atacama specimen. And so, you know, I did the experiments on that and we showed it was human. But that was the beginning of it, which then, of course, brought me to the attention of other individuals, one of whom was Jacques Vallée, who basically said, okay, well, here's a supposedly credible scientist who's interested in this area. And because we happen to live nearby, he lives up in San Francisco. It's basically about 45 minutes from here. We got together and we hit it off. The first thing, though, I learned about Jacques is that he can take, your preconceptions and deconstruct them very quickly. And so in a way, I count him amongst my three or four mentors in science. You know, one is Lenin, Lee, Herzenberg, who were my mentors in grad school at Stanford. Another is a guy by the name of Ali Zaleh, who was I still know quite well, was my mentor from undergrad, David Baltimore at MIT, and Jacques. So it's he's a true scientist and a very deep thinker. He's unnerving in his ability to find holes in your arguments. And so that's a good thing, because that's what you want. And he's probably the one who has most taught me about how to be very careful about claiming you have a conclusion.
Yeah.
All it takes one disproof and your conclusion is done.
Yeah. And you said you were working in your lab and you were approached by people in the CIA?
People from the government, people who said that they were associated with the CIA. And that was the beginning of the injury studies that we did on a cohort of probably about 100 patients, the majority of whom ended up, the ones who especially got extremely sick, the majority of whom now we understand to mostly be Havana syndrome patients, or to have symptoms which are extremely similar to. I mean, the problem with Havana syndrome is that it's a broad array of different problems.
So is that Havana syndrome attributed to UAPs or no?
No. So, I mean, this is where people, I think, have gotten pretty confused about the whole thing. You know, there were about probably, between 80 and 100, I don't know the exact number, patients who'd all been essentially put into a bucket. These are people who there was no explanation for how they had come to be hurt. And they were a range of things that were, they were hearing noises in their heads. They were, getting sick. They were, and then amongst them were a few experiencers. Now I don't have all the details. Kit has all the details on everybody, but remember, this is circa 2012, 2013.
So this is after OSAP ended?
Yes. Okay. And so we didn't know what was wrong with these people. They'd been basically handed over to Kit and said, can you figure these people out? And it wasn't really until 2018, 2019, when Havana syndrome started to really reach a crescendo of noticeability, that Kit realized that many of our patients had symptomology similar to the Havana syndrome. And the good thing about that was, frankly, it took those people out of our cohort because they became the government's problem, right? Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that's important about any science is categorization.
Yeah.
And at least as it turns towards the UAP problem, it's about getting, I think, the most, let's say, outrageous or the most spectacular things that attract everybody's attention on or off the table. And so taking them off the table now lets you focus your time on other things that might be important. And, because somewhere there's a diamond in the rough. Most of the things that I've looked at so far has just been the rough.
Yeah.
Taking them off the table.
And for the caudate nucleus and the putamen, those were people that were having experiences?
So that became a coincidental finding, right? So we weren't looking for it. We were just looking at the damage in some people's brains. And at least at the level of resolution of the MRIs that we had, there were some people who were clearly damaged and it looked like, sclerosis in the brain, immune system damage or some sort of damage, scarring. And by pure luck, the images were taken provided in a plane that basically bisected the basal ganglia more or less around the area here. I mean, of course, it's a whole MRI in 3D, but the ones that we happened to look at were sort of midline. And we noticed in a few of the individuals that they had a clear, basically looked like, at the beginning, we thought it was what's called white matter disease. But it's like, okay, well, we were excited at first because we thought that whatever the issue was with these people, it was focused on that area of the brain. But then the flip side of it, when we were looking at it, we had, wait a second, if you look at this other, these other ways of reading an MRI, you realize this was living tissue. And then you realize that, okay, this is actually a normal part of the brain. But in these individuals, it was hyperextended, right? Or over dense. Now, why that's interesting is when we looked at a control set of individuals, you didn't find it. And yet in these individuals, you did. So we started thinking, or at least asking, well, what could be special or what's different about this group of individuals? Now, remember, a lot of these people ended up being Havana syndrome. They had no experiencers. You know, there were a few experiencers, and there were just by chance, we threw in a couple of remote viewers.
Yeah.
And just because we had the MRIs for other reasons. Now, so what was similar about all these individuals was that they were, as Kit called them, high functioning, right? So it was actually the notion was that this might be an indicator of some kind of intellectual attribute. Now, the area of the brain that it's in, and for a variety of reasons, we came to a conclusion that this somehow was an indication of perhaps, this is all speculation, and I want the audience to know that everything I'm saying here is speculation, no conclusions. That this might be involved in intuition. And when we started looking in the literature, lo and behold, there was a lot of evidence that this area is involved in goal planning, intuition, intuitive leaps, et cetera. You can construct a story around it that's just a story that is more or less the beginnings of hypotheses that can be tested. And so, you know, one of the first things you do in, you know, creating a hypothesis from data is go back and try to redo the data if you can. Now, we can't do the data with the MRIs of the individuals from before for a variety of reasons. So you start with a new data set. And so I've been working with a lab at Harvard to recreate the data set, not about experiencers or anything like that, but about the, you know, is this area of the brain somehow related to various kinds of intellectual abilities? So first thing we did was of the materials, the MRIs that we had, we were able to go back now, and rather than have where Kit went and manually determined the density, double blind with another forensic neuropathologist, we created an artificial intelligence program that basically accomplished the same thing.
Wow.
And then validated what Kit had seen. So that's good. In fact, we've submitted a paper now that's close to this. But what we're doing is now, rather than just looking at the caudate putamen, the AI program can segment all areas of the brain. And so now we can start to look for correlations. If this is here, is there something else there? Because Kit had already started to see some other areas of the brain that were also different in these high functioning individuals. So, you know, the exciting part is that we actually have begun to find something interesting here. And we've been doing very mainstream work, right? We're looking at individuals who have schizophrenia, individuals who have who are autistic spectrum disorder, and then normals, because, you know, when you're doing this kind of research, you want a baseline of normality. And the reason why autism spectrum disorders are interesting is because, you know, it's in many of these individuals, it's a form of high functioning.
Yeah.
Right. So they were a great data set to look there to test some of the hypotheses. And the schizophrenia, it's another disorder that in some cases involves hallucinations. And so you could say that these experiencers are hallucinating, right? And so it would be, it's a great bracket, but in and of itself, the study that we're doing is mainstream interesting.
Yeah. So, and Harvard recreated it, or you're recreating it with Harvard?
Yeah, I'm working with them, yeah.
And where, do you know where the paper would be published?
Well, it's submitted.
Okay.
I never talk about where it's
sure. It's
done. The journals don't need to be harassed.
Yeah. And is that the Harvard study also including experiencers as well?
No.
Okay.
No. It's mainstream. Because eventually we have to get it funded.
Yeah.
Right? And so to get it funded, you need, you know, mainstream effort. And so it was my idea to, you know, create the study this way, because the results in and of themselves are interesting. What areas are related to intelligence or to dysfunction of these two very interesting types. And yet it forms a perfect backdrop. Should we ever turn back to experiencers to collect their information? Because now we'll have a baseline against which to compare it. We'll have a track record in the literature. We'll have we'll understand better the kinds of interesting questions we should be asking.
Yeah. And getting back to the idea of that, you started working with Kit and everybody after OSAP. So would that be under ATIP?
I don't know. These acronyms, I just, to be honest, I don't pay attention to them.
Yeah.
Probably should, but I don't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I get OSAP ended. So I guess it would have had to have been within that realm. And did you correlate with Luis Elizondo during that time?
No, I didn't meet Lou until probably right around the time of the release of the videos. It was about a month or so before the release of the videos that I became aware of Lou. I was very aware of the Tic Tac episode circa 2015.
Okay.
Sorry about the barking.
Yeah.
One second. I've gotten to know Lou and that whole crowd better, you know, over the last few years.
And he'd mentioned in previous interviews that some of the people that were part of the study were affected from the Nimitz incident.
There are good reasons why I shouldn't say one way or the other. Okay. Nobody wants their medical history discussed on the internet.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to stay away from that.
Yeah, for sure. And are you familiar with the slide 9? The ATIP briefing slide 9.
Can you show it to me? I don't.
I can't show it to you right now, but it said, you know, it's a briefing slide, and it said, it was talking about the different attributes of UAP. One of them was cognitive human interface.
Mm-hmm.
What is that supposed to mean?
You know, my understanding of it is that it's supposed to mean that somehow these things can interact with people. I have zero experience of that and zero knowledge. So again, I'm just repeating what other people have said.
Yeah. And in the also in slide 9, it said alterations and manipulations of biological organisms.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Did you ever come across that?
I mean, again, I no, I don't remember anything. I mean, I'm not being coy here. I just don't remember anything. I mean, again, it's so many of these things, and the questions you're asking, James, and I'm not being negative about this, is it puts me in the position of saying something that might be proven wrong 5 years from now. And yet right. I will spend the next 5 years chasing my answer around the internet.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I've learned, you know, and again, this is around this lesson came from the Atacama. I've learned that speculation is often perceived by many people as you've stated a fact. And then when you say something different later, you know, people say, well, you said this before. I said, no, I didn't say that before. I speculated before.
Yeah, right.
And so I've just learned speculation is just dangerous. It's, okay. They're great questions.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna basically spend my time chasing myself across the internet for the next 10 years.
Sure. So let's get to something that you can talk about, which is less speculatively a bit, is the materials.
Mm-hmm.
So you have been studying alleged UFO materials. Can you give some background about that?
Well, so just like, you know, studying the brain, it's an MRI that I can do an analysis of, and I can hand it to a colleague, and they can rerun the analysis my way or a different way and prove or disprove what it is that I think I'm seeing. So materials are the same way. So I'm, you know, and I've had this conversation with others before, I'm less interested in arguing about memos and historical writings from, you know, the government than I am working on materials or physiology that is reproducible. And so, that's the reason why I'm interested in focusing on materials, is because it's something that I can study. And then if I get a result, I can take a piece of it and send it to somebody else and say, do you see the same thing? And so the materials are things that mostly, frankly, have come from Jacques Vallée.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's spent his career finding cases that very often don't have very much public knowledge of them. The Trinity case is a case in point, completely obscured in history. And the reason why he wants to do these things, the kind of on the side, is because they don't get contaminated by public discourse. Right. So whatever happened at Roswell is so contaminated that it's almost worthless talking about it, at least to me, unless you have a material. So the cases that Jacques has gone after are ones that have verifiable witnesses that you can talk to later, that he has in many cases, or most cases, visited the individual, sat at their kitchen table, gotten to know them, and got the story out of them. Or in many cases, there are multiple witnesses. And so the case in point that we published is the Council Bluffs incident, where an object was seen by up to 11 witnesses. They arrived at the site of the so-called deposition of the material within minutes of it being dropped. And there's a very good chain of evidence around it, meaning that it didn't get handed through five other people. And so that was worth studying. And Peter Sturrock had studied it previously, right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to publish something that somebody has already done. you know, I mean, you can do that, but it's less interesting unless you can bring something new to the table. And that was what we did. We brought a new kind of analysis that both verified what he saw and found some other interesting things. And it was primarily done on a what we believed is still an interesting case, but there was nothing spectacular found. I mean, there was some weirdness about the metal in that it was what we call inhomogeneous. It wasn't a thoroughly mixed metal. So why, I don't know. There were no strange isotope ratios or anything like that. But the point of it was to say, this is how you do it, right? And this is how you get a peer review. It took almost 2 years from submission to acceptance, not because there was any controversy around it, it was because I was doing the experiments all myself. I couldn't ask one else to do it for me. I had to do all the analysis, all the you know, the writing, learning about things that frankly I knew nothing about at the beginning, and then just finding time to do it in my day job. But the reviewers were actually throughout the process very positive about the paper, actually from the beginning. And then getting it published was, I think, an important milestone. But now it's what I call burn the pipeline. Now we have an example of how to do it. And there'll be a number of other relatively banal cases we're going to publish. And then publish them until people are like, well, there's nothing interesting here. Stop publishing this stuff. And so then we'll probably write a general paper with about 10 different things just to get the data out there.
Yeah.
Not because it concludes anything, but it becomes, again, that flag in the sand of this is what you can do. And maybe somebody will look at the data and they'll say, I understand now. This is what's going on.
So have you come across any materials that are like, wow, this is really interesting in regards to UAP?
I mean, the only ones are the ones that Jacques has talked about previously that we did, which was the Ubatuba event, where there appear to be anomalous magnesium levels, and at least the isotope ratios. You know, that's still got to be verified. It's very confusing. Frankly, I have the data on my computer, and should I be able to find the time, I'll go through it. But to be clear to the audience, it's not just like, oh, you do it and the data's there. It requires all kinds of validation. So it's still speculative at this point. But the one thing that at least was interesting was that we had two pieces of the so-called event, which came from separate chains of custody. To the eye, they look exactly alike. But we took two pieces from each of them and did a secondary ion mass spec on them in an incredibly sensitive instrument, all done at the same time on the same sample holder. And one of them showed normal and the other, well, two samples of one of them showed normal and two samples of one of them were wrong.
Yeah, I mean, what could that mean?
So first of all, assuming that there was no mistake made, what it would tell you is that somehow it was the result of a non-natural process. So it's either somebody made it that way on purpose for a reason we can't understand, because we don't understand why people would do or use different isotopes of magnesium for anything. It is downstream of an industrial process that started with normal and created these differences. I don't know which. Either of them is interesting because you have to ask the question, why would anybody do it? Right. It's not so much interesting as to that the isotope ratios are different. It's interesting, why would you do it and what kind of purpose would it have?
Yeah. And you mentioned in another interview that there were bigger samples that I guess you weren't able to talk about publicly because there's a national security issue around them?
Yeah, I don't know where that kind of came. Yeah, I mean, there are those things.
I mean, why is that though?
Well, I wouldn't say there's national security. It's that somebody and people in the government have them and I can't get a hold of them. I will get
okay. Them. You will?
Yes. Yeah.
Are you going to get it through the recent development of the defense bill?
Yeah. At least whether I get a hold of them or whether I, you know, help with the suggestions on how to analyze it is, you know, we'll see.
Do you know where the materials are from?
No clue. I just know that they have some interesting stuff.
Do you know what makes the materials interesting at all, or it's just okay?
No. Don't know.
Okay. But you're developing a new device to look at materials, possibly?
Yeah, there's, you know, I think the next stage of analysis has to go beyond, okay, it's got these metals or isotopes in them. The next stage is understanding the atomic position, right, of where the atoms are. I mean, so, you know, where atoms are from different elements or even isotopes in a structure is everything. Structure equals function, right? You know, it's developing instruments that can do that is really the next step. There's an instrument out there already that can get close, but there's other ways to do it. In fact, there's multiple other ways to do it, and so I'm pursuing a couple of them.
I want to switch gears a little bit back to the biological effects. You know, based on kind of the work that you were doing with Kit and, you know, his DIRD report, at least the title of it, and everything was released. What do you think possibly may be revealed to the general public about UAPs and biological effects in the near future?
Well, I think the simplest thing is for the same reason you don't stand close to the back end of a jet engine. You know, anything that uses a lot of energy or is manipulating energy, you don't want to be near when it's, you know, running. It's like, you don't stand next to a power generator, you know, during a lightning storm, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what we're going to learn. And so I don't think that there's anything magic about that. It's like, don't get close to the stove, you know, when it's on.
But that is in turn a form of physical evidence of something, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly, you know, there's the Cash Landrum case as well.
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow.
One example, I'm blanking on his name. The guy who was in the forest with his buddies.
Travis Walton?
Yeah, the Travis Walton case is a perfect example of something like that.
Do you guys have data from that case?
No.
Okay.
I'm just saying, it's in their example.
Yeah, he got blasted back.
You know, don't get close to stuff that, you know, don't stick your fingers in the gears.
Yeah. Well, even I believe Christopher Bledsoe had said that, you know, he had gotten close to some UAPs and that there were effects that occurred from, you know, to his health from that.
Right. And what's that case in England? The
Rendlesham?
Yeah, Rendlesham.
And, or John Burroughs.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I met John back in the day with actually Colm at the time. And, you know, I mean, he had claims of some sort of issues. And Kit was demonstrably helpful to actually getting John the kind of medical care that he needed. I mean, that's one of the things I think that the one of the unsung heroes in all of this is Kit and the lengths that he's gone to help people. And people have had, you know, negative things to say about him and, you know, et cetera. You know, the people he's helped and saved who were ignored over all of these years, including a lot of these now Havana syndrome, what we think are Havana syndrome patients, they were ignored. Nobody was listening to them. You know, Kit was there and listened and then followed up.
Yeah. And some of these effects, like there's a lot of talk about the hitchhiker effect, even in the new book, Skinwalkers of the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a trackable thing? There's been talk, I think even Dr. Eric Davis said something about the hitchhiker effect and the immune system.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's trackable. You know, I don't have any immediate evidence of it. The main reason is, as I've said, that it's an inflammatory event, right? If you get sick, for instance, you have an inflammatory event. White blood cells activate. There's all kinds of things that go on. And there's a peak, there's a rise. There's a rise, there's a peak, and then there's a denouement. It goes away. And the longer between the acute event and the measurement that you try to do, the harder is the signal to see, right?
Yeah.
And depending on the kind of signal that you're looking for. So what I've said to the people who are involved is I need acute cases.
Yeah.
I need the blood within a few days or a week of this event.
You think with the Gillibrand amendment that is going to occur?
I would hope so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think injury was one of the
I mean, that's
things that was said that was called out there.
And but so the hitchhiker we're talking about, is there any way to verify that it had gone from person to person other than anecdotal kind of observations?
Well, I mean, you could have an anecdotal observation, but if you have evidence of you know, some sort of inflammatory event that moves from one person to another, then that would be such a thing.
Oh, wow. And was that at all tracked?
No. Yeah. I mean, I know of one case where it tracked through a family, but there was no claims, but there was no blood taken.
In a
timely enough manner.
Yeah. And, you know, again, talking about the hitchhiker, there's talks of, you know, kind of positive UAP events and negative UAP events. And there's been talk about, you know, possibly being able to avoid having any of these events occur to you at all. Is that possible?
Well, I was invited several times to go to the ranch, and I refused.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't know, but it's like, I have zero interest in making myself a target.
Yeah. Yeah. So
not that I believe there's anything haunted about the place or anything like that. It's just, I could see no compelling reason to be a tourist.
Yeah. Yeah. And, what are your thoughts on if we want to talk about contact in a larger scope? I know obviously people listening to this channel are going to be familiar with CE5, and I know you don't want to speculate too much, but if people can have the experiences and it's almost, you know, bar none, every time that there's some kind of cognitive or telepathic event seemingly, at least through people's experience. So, you know, if people are kind of having an interaction in that way, you know, the idea of CE5 is that you can turn that around and use that cognitive functioning to have an interaction with UAP.
You know, set them up with video, set them up with brainwave monitors, all of that, you know, do it in a controlled manner. Don't go out to the middle of the desert, you know, and come back and tell me something happened.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, do you think that's something that could actually occur and be studied? I mean, because again,
I think you could set up a study to do it, whether whatever it is that people claim they're interacting with, behaves, and, you know, shows up when, you know, on demand is a different story. You know,
yeah.
I mean, imagine maybe the stuff is, or whatever it is shy. It doesn't, it's not here to prove to you or to a crowd at large that it's real. Maybe it's a more personal thing.
Right. Yeah. And for sure, at least in this case, dependent on the UAP phenomenon or, you know, the interaction of the phenomenon, it's, you know, we don't control the whole thing. They're holding the cards, you know,
but as Jacques has said, whatever people think is going on has been going on for thousands of years.
Right.
Plenty of opportunity, again, speculation. It's had plenty of opportunity to show up and say with a finality, here we are. Here.
Right. Yeah.
And yet it doesn't. So that in and of itself should tell people something, that it's not, it's not going to behave according to your expectations, you know?
Right.
And, you know, as many have said, it's, you know, it even seems to have a precognitive ability.
Yeah.
So I think you're going to trick it.
Well, and that's, and I'll tell you from a lot of my experiences, when I had intended, like, oh, okay, I'll probably go do a CE5 because I have the opportunity. And sure enough, before I even start the process, I go outside and there's some kind of event that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting to me is that there is that level of interaction. And it's usually not under the circumstances of I'm going to prove this. It's when you have a genuine intent for some kind of interaction, it seems to occur, for at least for a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that very interesting that there's that interactive component. I find that highly interesting.
Maybe it is. But again, if you're going to prove it in a scientific sense, you're going to have to come up with some sort of way to record it, validate it. And if it has an effect on people, or at least, you know, they perceive something, it should be, they should be basically, somebody should be measuring their brain waves, EEGs, you know, you name it.
Would you be interested in a study like that or an opportunity like that?
I mean, what do you mean that I would run such a study? I mean, I think this is Dean Radin's area more than mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
Dean does
seem to have an idea. Yeah.
So I would, you know, he's a scientist of the highest order when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah. And, speaking of, you know, it's the phenomenon or UAP basically holding the cards in the sense, what do you think of Jacques Vallée's control model?
Well, I mean, it makes sense. You know, I have no reason to disbelieve him. I think, you know, perhaps the Galileo project has an opportunity to collect now the kind of data worldwide that could be fit into some kind of a statistical model, you know, if they actually observe anything, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my main concern, you know, given what we've just been talking about and Jacques' idea of the control model is that it might just say, okay, well, I know you're looking here. I won't show up.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but again, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So,
yeah. Yeah. And you actually had just recently signed on to the Galileo project.
Yeah. It's exciting. Yeah.
What do you,
organization? I sat in on one of the Zoom meetings last week.
What do you hope that will come out of Galileo Project?
Well, in the best possible world, they'd be able to track something which has, if not individual events, collectively multiple individual events show a pattern of behavior.
Yeah. And how do you take the kind of the recent open talk about this issue, even Representative Andre Carson calling for open hearings this year, he said? I mean, again, he's calling for it. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, it can only be a good thing, right? It's opening up the discourse. More people are paying attention to it. I mean, the evidence of people's interest in this area is already known that, you know, the New York Times articles were like some of the most viewed articles that the New York Times has ever had, right? The 60 Minutes episode is of a similar viewership. You know, the public, I think what's changed is the realization that the public is not going to all run screaming into the streets, that we're being invaded or something, right? If it's not affecting your day-to-day life, most people aren't paying attention to it.
Right.
And, you know, people have stuff to do. I have stuff to do beyond, you know, this area of, you know, call it a hobby. So, you know, if it suddenly becomes more present, then that will be, you know, then people will pay more attention. But again, scientists will want evidence. And so Avi's of the same opinion as I am. You know, he can collect data that would be reanalyzable by others, right? And then they'll peer review it.
Yeah.
He's put together quite an amazing organization, to be honest.
Yeah, there's a lot of really, high-level people signed on. And, you know, I think it's kind of galvanizing. And I think it, again, opens the doors for more scientists and academics. And even with that, the public interest of looking into these issues.
Well, I think the other thing is that there's, you know, there are people, and I've seen some in the Twitter threads and stuff have said, oh, well, now they've got all the true believers signing on, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, first of all, no, you know, I'm not a true believer. You know, Jacques is not a true believer. Neither is Lou or Chris. We're all looking for evidence. You know, so I think though that this group and Jacques especially can bring a lot of experience to the table. It doesn't mean that they're right. And, you know, I don't think Jacques, Lou or Chris or I are looking to lecture anybody. But what it does though, is for those who were afraid of some of the more strange elements of this, realize that actually everybody who's coming to the table has a scientific approach to it, Jacques especially. And, you know, it's, so I think that there will be an opening of the mind, but it's also a bit of a lesson to some of the so-called skeptics is you can only play skeptics so long, and you can only be irrationally skeptic, you know, and make fun of people who have these ideas for so long before the tables get turned, right? Where you, and I've said this to some of my colleagues, what scientist takes an idea off a table when it isn't proven or disproven? And it, you know, and it could be part of the answer. You know, a bad scientist does that.
A scientist
who's already closed their mind. And so, you know, don't lecture me about my reputation when you're the one besmirching your own.
Yeah, I'd say your reputation precedes you. Your previous work is pretty incredible. So I would think that people would have kind of rationale that if somebody's like you is looking into this in a very credible way, that it should be taken seriously, right? It's not just some kind of wild adventure.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, at the very least, it is a puzzle. And for someone like me who likes to solve puzzles, it's catnip.
Yeah.
Because at one level, as I've sort of been hinting at, I don't think we're going to solve it in my lifetime.
Right.
So, you know, but I'm addicted to answering difficult questions, right? Because I'm not, once it's answered, I actually lose interest.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is the perfect reality video game.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think of the idea of, say, this is all classified human technology?
If it is, then shame on those people for keeping that kind of stuff behind the scenes, because it could save humanity. You know,
yeah.
If they've been keeping this sort of stuff behind the scenes, they should all be put in jail. Right. With frankly, war crimes.
What are the implications of some of the technology?
Well, what's the energy source to allow for some of this stuff? Right. I mean, that alone is interesting. You know, I mean, it's all about today energy. Right. Being able to and not polluting the planet. Right. So if technology that doesn't pollute and, you know, could stop us from burning oil, no matter what you think about climate change, it's a good thing.
I think.
Now, the flip side of it is, and this might be part of the rationale, is that if it becomes so easy to create and use such energy, somebody could misuse it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a thousand different ways too much energy could be misused.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in some cases it would seem that it's already being misused, at least on a small scale, but I understand that kind of energy could be catastrophic in a regard. Let's speculate. If we are dealing with some kind of non-human intelligence, you know, what do we do with that?
Well, I mean, one, you try to figure out its intent, right? Two, you try to communicate with it if it's willing to talk back. And maybe it's completely uninterested in talking back.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, we're not the center. I mean, the first thing is it says to you, you're not the center of the universe.
Yeah.
Right. And that you're part of an ecosystem of some sort.
Yeah.
You're I can't remember who said it, but it was Lou. You know, we're not the top predator. Right.
Yeah.
We're not the top of the food chain anymore. And I mean, in the most hopeful sense, it might make us realize that we have more in common with each other than not. But it at the same time makes you realize that you're smaller and bigger than you thought you were before. Right? You're smaller in that you're part of a larger ecosystem. But you're bigger because you're part of a bigger ecosystem. So it expands your mind to other possibilities. So to me, that's exciting.
Yeah. And what you're saying about the interaction part, that's one of my primary interests. And, you know, again, if we take it even with a grain of salt, there's a history of UAP phenomenon and interaction with humans.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that interactive part is absolutely important. And that's why
the limit of all it's ever going to let us, right? I mean, I said this before, is that, you know, you don't teach your child by giving them everything.
Yeah.
And you were barely out of the caves, right? I mean, we're one step away from getting back into the caves, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you give a culture everything, they don't need to think for themselves or mature for themselves, then, you know, you aren't growing an equal partner, right? You're growing something that becomes a culture that becomes dependent on you. You know, we might be tens of thousands of years away from what it is that we need to be before we can interact with whatever this is at a higher level. And there's a lot of maturity that probably needs to come between now and then. We're certainly far from it now.
Yeah. And again, speculation, out of all the kind of like UFO or UAP hypotheses, do you have one that you think is the coolest as a sci-fi guy?
Yeah, I think, you know, the notion that there's a greater reality embeds itself in. But the other way to look at it is, and people kind of, you got to think a little bit about it. The universe is, at least our current physics understanding of it, is, you know, composed of particles, which aren't really particles, they're waves, they're, you know, you can't pinpoint and point at anything. You know, they're all quantum fluctuation waves. You know, you and I are, we interact with each other this way, and we're just a bundle of quantum waves. It just, our meat brains decide to put a skin on it, if you will. So that's just one way that energy can organize itself into matter. Maybe there's other ways that energy can organize itself. You know, and that's what these things are. Or maybe, you know, our corner of reality that we call our universe is part of something much, much larger that we don't even have the math to begin to understand, and we couldn't understand it if we wanted to. Even if somebody handed us the math, because it would only be a barely distant reflection of whatever reality is. And maybe these things are from there. And so, you know, and they somehow just have a way of occasionally stepping in our direction. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think it's possible that we will evolve more and create better technologies to sense and observe and, again, possibly interact with UFO phenomenon?
Maybe. I mean, I hope so. I mean,
yeah.
Again, yeah. I would love to, before I pass on to the next wherever, feel that there is some finality to the story, even though I know that it's only the beginning of probably a very long road. You know, I mean, just look at Jacques and Hal and the others who've been working on this forever, and they're, you know, they're all in their 80s.
Yeah.
And they are as in the dark as the rest of us, but still excited.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think there's going to be progress made with everything going on now with the Jill Brand amendment?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Have you ever personally sat in any of the briefings, or you were not allowed to do that?
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay. And you know, would you have any kind of like a message or parting words to? I'm going to go through a list here. So first, for skeptics, what would you impart to skeptics about the, you know, people looking into the UFO phenomenon?
Well, one, be patient. You know, two, be more open-minded. Three, don't come up with ridiculous answers. And expect, frankly, and this is, I would say this to the people, let's say the non-skeptics, challenge the skeptics when they come up with an answer. Your answer is just as much speculation as anything else. Prove your speculation. Don't just say something and wave your hand and walk away, right? Because that's it's just rhetoric at that point. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not skepticism. But, yeah. You know, but that said, skeptics play an important role in a way. There, it's like a form of peer review. Yeah. But if somebody in a peer review says something really stupid in a peer review, I just go to the editor and I say, I want this person dismissed because they're clearly, they have animus.
Yeah. Right? Do you think there's a possibility for like a repeat of, you know, what's happened in the past of this issue getting shut down?
Oh, it's all about politics. So potentially, I think it's less likely, but I'm not going to make any absolute statements about what I think is going on or could happen.
Yeah. And what would you say to academics who are interested in this kind of subject, but they're not fully out there?
Well, I mean, you might be interested, but it does come down to, is there money available to do the study? Right. So my suggestion is lobby to have funds set aside to do these kinds of studies. Right. Yeah. But while those monies are not available, if you think that there's a way to approach it, that starts to create the background data like I'm doing with the MRIs, prepare.
So you're setting yourself up for success.
Exactly. I'm preparing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, again, Gary, thank you so much for coming on here and spending your time with me. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the work you do.
Time flies very fun.
Yeah. And even though this conversation made me a little grim, not exactly, but it makes it seem more difficult in a sense.
Well, science is hard.
Yeah.
I think people have gotten too used to clicking a link and expecting an answer. If you want an answer faster, get involved. Don't just sit an armchair tweet at people.
Yeah. Are there ways you think that people in the general public
organize? I mean, again, look at what Avi did. He created an organization. I mean, it needs leaders, people who are capable of doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
But, get involved. Critics with no solutions, and a solution can be just your hands, are useless to me.
Yeah. Do you have an idea of how other people can get involved? What other things can be done?
Any of a number of organizations. Or create your own if you think something's not being done.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say, another blog or another podcast is not going to do anybody any good.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's more than enough qualified people like yourself who've been involved for a long time. And if you got something new to add, that's great. But, organize somehow. Lobby. Yeah. Write letters to your political representatives.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is probably going to be a drawn out process. I think it's a long time, but I think people are hopeful, and I understand that. I mean, having the Pentagon just basically say that UAPs are real. Those are milestones, and I can see people are excited about that. But
I've been given this false hope of disclosure. That there's going to be a day when everything changes.
Right. Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you about that. And I'm sorry I didn't get to that.
I don't think there's going to be such a day. I just don't think so. I think it's going to be a slow realization. At that point in time, it'll be so obvious that it won't be a surprise to anybody.
I know. You think that's by design?
I don't know if it's by design or if it's just by how humans deal with mental conflict.
Yeah.
And a reorganization of where you are in the universe.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen all at once. Even for like me, who've been thinking about this kind of thing since I was 10 years old. Because the variables now start to minimize, and you know, the boundary conditions of, you know, it could be anything, start to become more settled. And so how that impacts your life is really, I think, where people are going to be making a lot of spending a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah. And for the last question, what do you think like the greatest thing would be that you could see in your lifetime come out of this issue?
New technology that helps people, or a new realization of where we are that helps people, you know, not spend all their time fighting with each other.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm an optimist.
I am too. Even I am too, Gary. And again, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you coming on here. I appreciate all the work you're doing. I think you're a true pioneer. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for all your efforts too. Much appreciated. Okay.
All right. I'll see you next time. Take care, Gary.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye now.